Donc, chers amis, bon, pour cette dernière conférence de la matinée, nous avons le plaisir d'entendre de façon virtuelle ou en distanciel, comme on dit maintenant, Sonia Roca-Royes, qui est actuellement Senior Lecturer à l'Université de Stirling. Ses recherches, comme vous le savez pour beaucoup, hein, se concentrent dans les domaines de la métaphysique et de l'épistémologie des modalités, bien qu'elle s'intéresse également plus largement à l'épistémologie, l'ontologie, la philosophie des mathématiques et de la logique, ainsi que la philosophie du langage. Sonia Roca-Royes a publié des travaux dans des revues telles que Dialectica, Nous, Mind et Synthèse, ainsi que des volumes collectifs qui ont été publiés par Oxford University Press et Synthesis Library de Springer. Elle travaille actuellement à une monographie sur la modalité pour la série Cambridge Elements, des presses universitaires de Cambridge. Le titre de sa conférence est « Conceptual Engineering and the Epistemology of Essence ». Sonia, I'll leave you the floor now. Thanks.
Okay, so thank you very much. Despite the fact that it was in French, I think I managed to understand most of it, and it's flattering. It's very, I'm very happy for the opportunity to be here, especially given that I wasn't able to travel for two independently already sufficient reasons. Some of you know. I've been having a look at the program and the abstracts that are available on Claudine's webpage, and I felt even sorrier that I'm not here because I'm finding it super interesting, and I would wish to be here and be able to interact with you all. But I'll be looking forward to accessing the recordings and hopefully catch up with you either virtually in a different on a different occasion or face to face in a not too distant future. So yeah, the talk is going to be, you can see the title here, it's going to be on conceptual engineering and the epistemology of essence. I know that Hanyu, if I may, has been already giving you some critical remarks on conceptual engineering moves, but I'm hoping, on the basis of the abstract that I have read, I'm hoping that the kind of conceptual engineering that I will be suggesting will be one that will survive that critical eye on it, but you will let me know. I'll be very interested to hear. And it's also going to be something that will manifest or illustrate the way in which, as Nathan, you've spoken earlier today, so something that Nathan says in the abstract, namely that the metaphysics of essence is going to be informed likely by the epistemology of essence. So I think that this talk is going to be quite a good example of one way in which that can happen. So let me then start. Here's the plan for today. And just by having a quick look at it, you can guess that section two is going to be the main section. But for me to make sense of that section, I need to give you, by way of summary, a little bit of research precedence of what is it that has brought me where I am currently with my research. So I'm going to spend two sections on my, by the way, sorry, by way of a footnote question, do you see my arrow moving around? Can I assume that you see where I want you to put the attention? Yes?
Yes, we do, Sonia, thank you.
Lovely, thank you, that's great. So I'm going to be summarizing very crudely. I'll be very bold with these summaries, and I can take questions later on, but I'll be summarizing my reasons for dissatisfaction against concept-based accounts of modality, and then my own inductive epistemology of possibilities, and what I'm going to be stressing in these summaries is going to then allow me to and allow you as well to make sense of what's going to happen in section two. So let me then start with the my reasons, my bold reasons against conceivability and more general concept-based accounts of modality. My position has been an evolving argument to the effect that concepts have a very limited role to play in the epistemology of essence and in the epistemology of modality in general, and in the epistemology of concreta in particular. I have argued against conceivability accounts by which I include accounts like Chalmers and Jablos, but also Williamson's. I have argued that conceivability is a guide to possibility, but only to the extent that the reasoner, the conceiver at each occasion has already something very much like essentialist knowledge already that is informing the conceivability judgments that the reasoner arrives at, which makes them then, which makes conceivability accounts then to be what we might call essence first epistemologies of modality. Namely, epistemologies according to which essentialist knowledge is epistemically prior to other types of modal knowledge, necessity and possibility. The problem with these accounts is that essentialist knowledge is not satisfactorily explained. It's rather something that the accounts would assume, but it hasn't been tackled directly or satisfactorily. Now, in the case of Chalmers and others, these essentialist information that the conceiver relies on, at least implicitly when judging in conceivability exercises, this essentialist information makes it into the concepts. So it's constitutive of the concepts with which we reason and with which we carry out these conceivability exercises. And this results then in accounts resting on what we now might call modally or essentially. By the way, another footnote, I'm not going to be distinguishing the modal and the essence, or the necessary and the essence here. I'm as I already anticipated that I will be bold. If you have issues having to do with my conflation for the purposes of this talk, I'll be very happy to address them in the Q&A. But for the time being, I'm not making a distinction between necessary and essential. So the account then rests on modally or essentially loaded concepts, by which we mean concepts whose application conditions require of the entities that are to fall under them to have a specific modal profile. So concepts, for instance, that require, one example would be a concept, let's call it, I'm going to be stipulative here, I'm not referring to our concept human, but I'm going to be stipulative here. Let's consider a concept which we can label human plus to be such that it is to apply to entities that are both human and also have their origins essentially. This is a modally loaded concept because it's part of the application conditions of that concept that the entities are to have a certain modal profile. In particular, they are to have origins essentially. Now, if, as a matter of fact, humans do not have modal our origins essentially, this concept is going to be empty, right? If it happens that humans have our origins essentially, this concept is going to be coextensive, likely, with the concept of human being. So human plus might then be coextensive with human. But this is just by way of introducing an example of a modally loaded concept and what we mean by this. Now, generalizing from conceivability accounts like Chalmers and others, the complaint that I have with respect to concept-based accounts more generally is that our epistemic access, my complaints generalize to concept-based epistemologies of essence more generally, not just conceivability accounts. And by concept-based epistemologies of essence, I mean epistemologies according to which our epistemic access to essential truths is fundamentally, ultimately tied to knowledge of conceptual truths in this way, in the way that you can exploit modally loaded concepts to extract from them by means of conceptual analysis to extract from them essentialist principles. For instance, conceptual analysis would give us the result that the following principle, whatever is a human plus, is such that their origins are essential. This is something that we could not mysteriously come to know by conceptual analysis if we have this modally loaded concept in our conceptual repertoire. So the idea is that concept-based epistemology of essence have been assuming that our knowledge, our actual knowledge of essence, would be along these lines. And my complaint with respect to them is that this epistemology is not going to work unless the concepts in our conceptual network are modally loaded in that sense, but I don't think that they are. I think that they are modally neutral, and in fact, it's a precondition for the usefulness of our concepts that they don't require us to know the essential profiles of things before we can knowledgeably apply our concepts, the concepts with which we categorize the world. Bold claim, but I'll leave it here. So I think that it's not in the nature of our actual concept human, for instance, that origins are essential to humans, okay? And that's what makes it possible for us to apply the concept human in a knowledgeable manner to things like me and things like you, organisms like you. Good. So I have recently strengthened that kind of complaint by an argument according to which even if some concepts were actually modally loaded, still concepts would have a very limited role to play in the epistemology of essence. I'm not going to go in detail into that argument, but to give you just the rubric of it, the problem is that if our concepts are modally loaded and therefore admitting that with these concepts we can generate knowledge of conceptual essentialist principles, if our concepts are modally loaded, now, the pressing question for the epistemologist of modality would rather be, how can we knowledgeably apply them? All right. So if our concept human really is akin to what I stipulated to be human plus, then I need a story. And I'm seeing some of you sitting there. Can I, on the basis of my recognitional capacities, can I apply knowledgeably the concept human plus to each of you? And the answer is going to be, well, not unless you know that they satisfy the essentialist condition, the essentialist constraint. If I can't discern whether your origins are essential or not, I'm not going to be in a position to knowledgeably apply human plus to any of you. So if our concepts are modally loaded, then the pressing question for modal epistemologists is going to be, how do I know whether you are a human plus or I am a human plus, if those are the conditions for applying that concept? So the idea that we can have knowledge of essentialist principles by conceptual analysis, all right, while at the same time, and this is important, while at the same time treating the knowledgeable applications of these concepts as unproblematic, that is a myth. You cannot have them both. At least you cannot have them both unproblematically. You can have one, you can have the other one, but when you put them together, they don't go well, unproblematically. We're not solving the problem of epistemic access to essence. We're just locating it on one part or the other one, but we need to be aware that by loading or by assuming our concepts to be modally loaded, we are locating the problem of the epistemology of essence on the application conditions of those concepts. Now, a saliently problematic feature of these accounts is that they rest all model knowledge, apart from what we have been seeing, they rest all model knowledge on essentialist knowledge. In the terminology of Bob Hell, they are suggesting a necessity or an essence-first account on the structure of model knowledge. So basically, a very crude caricature of these, of what I've got in mind here, is that possibility knowledge is explained somehow or somewhat derivative of essentialist knowledge. What you get first is knowledge of essence or knowledge of essentialist principles. And from this knowledge that you get as derived somehow from our conceptual analysis, you then, by deduction or by derivation, you get access to the cone of possibilities, because possibilities are being understood as whatever is compatible with the essences. And that's why these particular epistemologies have been traditionally been referred to in the literature as exemplifying or implementing the deduction model, all right? Kripke would be a very good example of a genesis of a deduction model. Now, this picture that you've got now on the screen is very powerful, super powerful, and it's very elegant, all right? If it succeeded, right, that's the problem. For me, it doesn't succeed. But the elegance is that it relies on the fact that if you want to elucidate modal knowledge, fine, focus just on the essences, and then from here, you can just automatically deduce the possibilities. And this is powerful because you're making your task, you're reducing your task to just a tiny set of phenomena to explain, namely explain essentialist knowledge, and then the rest is just biological deduction. The problems with this strategy, yes, they are very powerful, but that power precisely translates into fragility, all right? There is an extensional fragility there that I'm going to illustrate now. If you get the essences wrong, all right, if you, for instance, does this inner circle is sufficiently clear on your screen?
Yes.
Good. So if you were to think that essences, that there are less essential facts than actually there are, then you're going to think that the cone of possibilities is larger than it actually is, because you will be wrongly assuming that there are less constraints on objects, of ways the objects can be. And by contrast, if you thought that there are more essential facts than actually there are, you're going to think of the cone of possibilities as being smaller than it actually is. So you have this extensional fragility. You might easily get things wrong, but also there is an explanatory fragility that is associated with it. And that comes from the fact that or at least this is a bold claim, because essentialist knowledge is not satisfactorily explained, all right, then this explanatory deficit compromises in turn, by the same token, the explanations of possibility knowledge. And the reason is because on these accounts, possibility knowledge is parasitic on essentialist knowledge. So if you don't manage to elucidate essentialist knowledge adequately, that is going to infect as well the explanations of your possibility knowledge. This is one first problem, and this is a problem of explanatory deficit. Some people might think, well, not that big a problem. Yes, I agree. This is a deficit. Let's keep working now and develop an epistemology of essence such that we can then complete our explanatory agenda, all right? That would be good, but I think that there is actually a bigger problem, a different problem that is going to be more problematic than the first one. And that comes from the fact that on essence-first accounts, our rational degree of confidence that, for instance, this table on which the computer is lying at the moment, that this office desk can break, our rational degree of confidence about that possibility cannot be higher than our degree of confidence about my desk's essential properties. And the reason why it cannot be higher, it's because we're now facing a deductive model. So the possibility that this table breaks is being arrived at on the basis of essentialist premises. So your degree of confidence in the, this is just one instance of a general epistemological phenomenon, that normally the conclusions are not going to be epistemically more robust than the arguments by which we arrive at them. So if this is really how we get to know that my office table can break, then I cannot be more secure about that possibility. I cannot be more certain or confident about that possibility than I am about the essential properties of the table. And I think this is a very pressing problem. As a bold claim, I think that in fact our possibility knowledge, for at least some ordinary claims, is a lot more robust than any of our essentialist knowledge about concrete entities. And I take it actually that the literature, a sociological look at the literature would agree with me. There is a lot more disagreement about essential properties in metaphysics and in the metaphysics of modality than there is disagreement about these certain ordinary possibilities, at least. So this is a problem, and that problem is now no longer just an explanatory deficit. It's just an explanatory inadequacy problem. I mean, we're just getting the structure of model knowledge wrong if we try to make possibility knowledge parasitic on essentialist knowledge. And therefore, this problem, this inadequacy problem, calls for completely different approaches to epistemology of modality. And that was part of my motor convictions when I spent time in sketching an inductive epistemology for precisely those possibilities that I think are super robust, knowledge of which I think are super robust. So my reaction to these problems that we have seen in 1.1 and other shortcomings of existing epistemologies in the literature has been, okay, forget about essentialist knowledge. It would be very good if we had it. It would be, it might support a very elegant epistemology, but one that at the end, I think it's inadequate, not just deficitory. What can then we do to satisfactorily explain our robust knowledge of ordinary possibilities? Well, we need an epistemology of possibilities which is not reliant, not parasitic on antecedent essentialist knowledge or antecedent essentialist information, right? And the core idea of the inductive epistemology is that we know about unrealized possibilities because we have seen their type, their kind, realized somewhere else. For instance, how do I know that this office can break? It has nothing to do with my knowledge of its essential properties. I can be super blind about what the essential properties are. But how do I know it? Well, I mean, the table that I had before, that one, was pretty much like it. It had the same intrinsic nature, if you want, or intrinsic feature, intrinsic properties, and it broke. And I know that it broke because I saw it. So on the basis of what I've seen happening to other similar entities, I can extrapolate that knowledge and apply it to this table, which as of today has not realized the possibility of breaking, but I know it has it. So I also know that I could survive a 6-hour cardiac arrest because I know that this kind of survival has happened to another woman, and I'm relevantly similar to that organism for it to be legitimate to extrapolate what happens to her to what could happen to me. And again, the example of my desk. Now, all these examples, at least as I've been able to see so far, have a common pattern. And the pattern is that what we are using in reasoning is a principle of the form from something having certain actual properties to it possibly having other properties. Like, for instance, from something being a wooden desk, you can safely transition to something possibly breaking. From something being a woman, you can safely transition to something possibly surviving a cardiac arrest. From something being human, you can safely transition to possibly dying out of a car accident. Sorry about the disastrous tone of the examples. But this is a common pattern that has been inductively arrived at on the basis of our observations. I've seen a table that has broken, so that table could break, that one that I've seen broken, and you generalize tables can break, all right? This is an induction from this table has broken, that table has broken, that other table has broken to, all right, tables can break, all right? Currently, I am working on an extension of this epistemology, basically to the effect that it's not essential to that inductive epistemology that it always be possibilities that we transition to. I think it's open for us to potentially, with the relevant observations, it would be open for us to go from something having a certain actual properties to necessarily having certain others, all right, or having that one. So it is not essential that it be possibilities that we transition to. With adequate observations, we could transition to necessities as well, all right? The problem, a standing problem, something that prevails, at least as far as I'm seeing things as of now, is that for the typical essentialist principles that have generated a lot of discussion and that attract a lot of our research in cognitive activity in model epistemology, for those typical essentialist principles like essentiality of origins, essentiality of kind, we do lack the relevant observations. So these principles are not going to be candidates to being subsumed under the inductive epistemology that I favor. So the actual limitation is that this route, this inductive epistemology here, doesn't allow us to decide whether the typical essentialist principles like essentiality of origins or essentiality of kind are actually true or not. Now, graphically, and this is the last slide before turning to the second section, which is going to be not longer than this one, so don't worry about time. While essence-first epistemologies, as we have seen, are powerful yet fragile, this inductive strategy, I think of it as delivering slow but sure progress, all right? So what we do is we start our inquiries by being in the dark about what's essential, what's possible. We might have several hypotheses about what how large the set of essential properties is, and then correspondingly hypotheses about how large the cones of possibility, the cone of possibility is. But what we do, we're not going to be getting something as powerful as the essence first accounts. Rather, what we do with this inductive epistemology is to reveal single possibilities as present in the cone. For instance, that might be the possibility that my office desk can break. That might be the possibility that my neighbor's dog could jump the fence, et cetera, et cetera. So we reveal certain possibilities very robustly to be there, and in a way that it's not parasitic on any success about elucidating essentialist knowledge, all right? So we're going to be making enough progress, or at least quite progress. This progress about revealing the green dots, the possibilities, will in turn translate into a certain degree of essentialist knowledge, which we might call negative essentialist knowledge. And by this, what I mean is, like, for instance, assume that this green dot here is the possibility that my desk can break. Well, if I know that my desk can break, then I definitely know in turn that whatever the essential properties, I might not know what they are, but I do know that whatever the essential properties of my desk, they do not include that it's essential to eat, not to break. And this is just what I'm representing here with this tiny orange portion, this kind of negative essentialist knowledge. Similarly, I mean, the more possibilities we reveal, the larger this area of negative essentialist knowledge is going to be, all right? If we also manage to reveal possibilities lying here, all right, then this is going to translate into ruling out that the set of essential properties is as large as this, all right? Because if it were as large as this, then the cone of possibilities would be as small as this, but we have robustly revealed these possibilities here. So for instance, if one of them is that I can survive a 6-hour cardiac arrest, and let us assume that it was one of our hypotheses whether human beings cannot survive that long cardiac arrests, we are going to be now in a position to rule out that the set of essential properties is that big. So we're going to be having this kind of negative essentialist knowledge. This is quite a lot of progress. I mean, we are revealing quite a lot of the metaphysical, of the extension of our notions of essence and possibility, all right? But there are limitations that I sketched in the previous slide, and in particular, I think that essentialist claims like essentiality of origins or essentiality of kind on the basis of this picture now have to be located in this area that we can neither assert nor rule out either with this inductive epistemology. So here I'm just raising the question, could Gandhi be a cat? Or could Malala have Obama's origins? Well, we don't know. Maybe we don't know inductively. Maybe these possibilities are there. Maybe they are not. But the inductive epistemology allows us neither to assert nor to deny them. So it leaves us still in the dark when it comes to these possibilities. And this is a limitation that we need to acknowledge of the current inductive epistemology. So now the idea, we're now going to the second part of the paper, and it's going to be short because the idea can be very quickly presented, and then what I'm interested is in knowing your reactions about the suggestion. The idea now is that what I want to do is to axiomatize this picture, axiomatize this kind of knowledge that we do have robustly secured with this inductive epistemology. Okay, and that's what brings me now to conceptual engineering. I'm going to start with some metaphysical assumptions on material objects, which I take it are going to be quite uncontroversial. Here's the actual world. Here's a table that we're labeling A. It's no mystery that tables have spatial dimension. You can see this. This is trying to capture the three spatial dimensions of objects. That's something that is part of our conception of an object. It's also not unstandard. It's not non-standard. So it's standard that objects also have a temporal dimension. And if you agree with this temporal dimension, you probably want to call this table that you have now represented belonging to the actual wall. Many people take this table to be a four-dimensional worm, including the three spatial dimensions and the temporal one. Now, what I want you to envision for the time being is that something very similar can be said when we take into account the modal dimension. So, if we take seriously the claim that objects have a modal profile, we can translate that into them having a modal dimension as well. Now, how big modally is this table? We know how spatially big it is. I don't know, maybe 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter. We can know from the actual wall how temporarily long that object is on the basis of knowing when it was created and when in the future will disappear. How large modally is this table? The answer here is that, well, at least with inductive methodology that I favor, we do not know, but we do have some possibilities that we have revealed for this table. This table could in the future be painted green, it could be painted orange, it could be destroyed at any moment, it could last longer than that. So we do have certain possibilities for it that we have revealed by means of this inductive methodology. In all these possibilities, the origins are the same because we haven't said anything, we haven't been able to reveal with that inductive epistemology, we haven't been able to reveal possibilities that it has different origins, but we haven't been able to rule them out. So for all we know, and this is the proviso, for all we know, the manta ray picture. Okay, so this is just a terminological move that I'm making, that because these are now modally extended objects, I rather think of it as a manta ray picture than a worm picture, but this is just kind of a terminological joke. But I do think of objects modally extended as more as manta rays than as worm. I do picture them like that. But for all we know, this object, this table and its model profile is larger than that. And for all we know, it's just as small as it. We can't assert or rule out anything, okay? Now, here's one background assumption about the metaphysics of objects. When, in a context, when we simply point to, in a certain spatial direction where there is a table, we are going to be interpreted as referring to the largest spatially unified entity in the region that I'm being pointing at. So if there is this object around and I say this table weighs 23 kilo, I'm going to be interpreted as referring to the whole of that entity in that region, rather than, for instance, the portion that has shorter legs or a portion that has shorter legs. I'm referring to the largest spatially unified entity. Something similar can be said when it comes to the spatiotemporal dimension. If there is a worm and as of now in the present, I point to these and I say this has been around for 23 years, I'm going to be interpreted as referring to the whole worm rather than a final section of it, all right? And the suggestion that I want to make that now is that when we take into account also the model dimension, we probably have to understand our pointings in a similar manner. So projecting this assumption, when we speak of tables in a spatiotemporal modally sense, sorry about the phrase, I haven't found a more elegant one, but when we speak of tables in a spatiotemporal modally sense, by default, we're going to be speaking of the largest spatiotemporal modally unified entity, all right? So we're going to be referring to the entity that has the largest model profile of all possible of them. Now, if as a matter of fact, this table could have origins other than its actual ones, then when I'm saying this table could have, this table has origins essentially, then I'm speaking falsely. I'm saying something false about it, all right? The handicap here, on the basis of the limitations that I have identified in the previous section, the handicap here is that the limitations in section one amount to us not knowing how large, really, metaphysically, this entity is. I don't know how large it is. I do know it has a minimum size, though. All right, because what that epistemology did allow us to establish very robustly is that there are some possibilities for it, It can last longer. It can last less than that. It could be painted red. It could be painted green. These are just examples of possibilities. But I do know that it has a minimum model profile. I don't know whether this is a proper part of it or not, but I know it has that minimum size, that modally extended entity. So when I say of, in the actual world, when I say of this table, it has its origins essentially, I might be speaking falsely if there is more that I'm seeing of it, all right? It might be true if we're seeing all of it, if this is all of it, if seeing, by seeing now I mean having epistemic access to all of its possibilities. So if I'm seeing all of it, then this sentence is true because in all its possibilities, the origins are the same, all right? Oh, sorry about that. Good. But we do not know on the basis of the inductive epistemology. And this is a point at which I invoke a conceptual engineering move. That's what brings me to section 2.2. This is the minimum size of what we know about tables. And now think of the concept table. The suggestion now, it's a normative suggestion, is that as a matter of convention, our concept table should be so fashioned as to refer to the largest modally extended entity for whose existence we have evidence, regardless of whether there is a larger entity. That is to say, regardless of whether this entity that now I will be referring to with a concept like table is, metaphysically speaking, a proper part of a larger one or not. So the suggestion is, for those entities, for those perhaps larger entities, for which we cannot know that they are essentially, or we cannot have access about the essential properties, stop talking about them. Stop referring to them. Engineer your concepts such that you, with them, with your concepts, talk about portions, perhaps improper, perhaps proper, portions of modally extended entities for which you can then ascribe essentialist knowledge. This makes then now our concept table modally loaded, because now I'm stipulating that by table I mean things that have origins essentially and perhaps different futures that I will be able to reveal inductively. A very pressing question, a very pressing methodological question: what do we gain by this conceptual engineering move? Well, with concepts so engineered, we can confidently claim to know that my table's actual origins are essential to it, because now with table, I'm meaning these kind of portions of entities such that they satisfy that their origins are all the same, right? Basically, what we're doing, as I anticipated at the end of section one, basically what we are doing is we are axiomatizing the possibility knowledge that we have got and using the fact that those axioms are essential truths about certain portions of modally extended objects, whether proper or improper. This is what we do not know. So we're gaining essentialist knowledge. We're actually not just gaining essentialist knowledge, we're also gaining its expressibility. Because what I am doing now is I am engineering a concept with which to describe the essentiality of origins for these portions, which I couldn't do earlier on because my concept table failed to refer necessarily to these perhaps portions. We can come back to this later on. So basically what we're gaining is perhaps the power that we didn't have because we were an inductive approach. Now, what do we lose? Again, a very methodologically urgent question. And I want to hear from you, what do you think that we lose? At the moment, I don't think that it's clear that we lose much. A hypothesis, a potential loss here is that we maybe lose the conceptual resources for talk about things that we cannot know much about. If that's something that we lose, I take it that I've made it already sound as something that maybe we shouldn't worry too much about it. But as I said, I'm very much looking forward to hearing from your reactions about it. Now, just in one more slide, back to concept-based accounts, you might be thinking, wait a moment, Sonia, all this digression to end up with modally loaded concepts, and you started with an argument against? Yes, I'm afraid, yes, this is so. Despite my complaints against concept-based epistemologies, the suggestion now is that the concept table be so that it guarantees the essentiality of origins for tables. So what about the reasons that I had about that I had against concept-based epistemologies of essence? Well, very briefly, what happens is that now, not then, not at the beginning of the journey, epistemological journey, now we are in a much better epistemic position with these concepts than we were at the beginning of the journey with those concepts. Remember the challenge of explaining how can we knowledgeably apply them? This challenge doesn't arise for this view. In starting the journey with modally neutral concepts, we have been able to knowledgeably apply them to ordinary objects. We have been able to secure possibility knowledge and robust explanations as well about that knowledge. So we have been able to robustly know a minimum size of those modally neutrally identified tables, okay? And this secure, epistemically grounded possibility knowledge is what ensures a known minimum size of the modally extended objects, on which basis we can then decide to speak of the objects that are that big, regardless of whether there are bigger ones, without the risk of reference failure on the one hand, and regardless of whether, if anything, lies in the unseen portion of the cone. So there is no presumption here that there aren't any metaphysically, that there aren't any larger entities. There is no presumption at the same time that there are, all right? And there is no presumption that we can know whether there are. Precisely, the engineering suggestion is in fact a way of minimizing the harm of living with that ignorance. So it is a concept-based account that might result from this, but it's an empirically informed concept-based account, and that makes it, for me, a lot more secure and less risky than starting the epistemic journey with modally loaded concepts. Then you have the problems that I identified, which I don't think I'm facing. And this is all I wanted to say. Sorry about the rush. I think I've been quite quick, but thank you very much.